The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Natalie Nahai, and before we get going, I want to let you know that this week's show is sponsored by Squarespace. To discover the simplest way to build beautiful websites, just go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show. It's been said that the rise of digital technology has made artists of us all. We walk around with cameras in our pockets and sophisticated editing software at the touch of our screens. Proliferation of platforms like Instagram and Pinterest have meant that we now live in a world where we don't just document our lives, we also illustrate them. The visual has become the currency of the web, but what about the art world itself? How has the art world engaged with the shifting sands of our digital lives? Well, this week we're taking a step back from the screen to look at art in the digital age, tracing its history from cybernetics in the 1950s right up to the current post-internet artists engaging with big data and the open web. Joining us this week is The Guardian's art critic Adrian Searle, curator Helen Kaplinsky, data journalist David McCandless, and two artists engaging with the internet in very different ways, Julie Freeman and Ruth Catlow. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, when you hear the term net art, you'd be forgiven for imagining some sort of black screen with streams of green numbers cascading matrix-like down the digital abyss. But art has been addressing themes around tech since the cybernetic pioneers of the 50s. And artists, just like everyone else, have been interrogating the outcomes of computing and technology ever since. But recently, there seems to have been a renewed surge in appetite for art which engages with technology, with two major new exhibitions opening in London alone. One retrospective at the Whitechapel Gallery called Electronic Superhighway, which looks at the impact of computing and the internet on art since the 60s, and another at Somerset House called Big Bang Data, which explores the issues around the datafication of the world around us. Now, Helen, you are a curator and lecturer of a new course at the Tate called Art in the Age of Digital Drift. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of this source of art, so how it's evolved since the 50s?
One of the most important exhibitions, which is within the Whitechapel show and is actually also within the Tate archive, was a show called Cybernetic Serendipity. And Cybernetic Serendipity, just in terms of a title, captures the kind of chance encounter of the artist with the technology as well. So serendipity being this moment of chance operation, which in the 1950s, ideas of Brownian motion and molecules, behaviour being potentially randomised rather than being able to plan and observe everything in a kind of enlightenment view from above is really important.
It strikes me when you're talking there about serendipity and randomness that there seems to be a sense of wanting to make sense of the randomness, of codifying it in some way. Is this something that you've also experienced and that you look at within your course?
Absolutely. I mean, there's this trajectory which is very interesting in terms of how optimistic we are about the potential of technology to improve our lives, and then now the potential for technology to actually be our prisoner. Artists in the 90s saw the possibilities of actually sharing and producing your own platforms online when, you know, the corporations hadn't caught up in the 90s at that point. It was artists who were doing all of that. Now you have corporations capturing all of that data, but we're not in control of it.
Fascinating. So Adrian, I have a feeling that you might have something to say about this. You recently reviewed the new Whitechapel show. Why do you think that there's been this resurgence in interest around precisely what Helen's been talking about?
I don't think it's a resurgence. I think it's been constantly growing, really, since the first days that artists began to use computers, either as drawing tools or they were making, you know, one of the things about cybernetics was this huge interest in robots and robotics and also in behaviourism. And there was both a utopian idea about what technology could do for us and how we might be able to use it, but also kind of fear of what it might become. And a lot of the early art that's in the Whitechapel exhibition does have a sort of almost naive sensibility. And there was this group in New York called Experiments in Art and Technology, EAT. And in one of their projects, they got a radio station to hook up various microphones and cameras and TV sets in different locations in Boston, where people could say hello to each other in shopping malls and in recording studios. And it was, and they were all terribly excited about what now looks like the clunkiest. What, they got this fantastic medium, and what do they say? Hello, where are you? That's about as far as they got. But very soon, of course, artists were already using video. You know, the same. All the artists in New York had access to probably one or two video cameras, and they passed them between them. This was happening with sculptors and painters, performance artists, minimalists, you know, like Richard Serra and Nancy Holt and Carl Andre, in a way that was like, here's a new medium, what can we do with it? And I think the same thing has happened all through the development of what we might call net art. Artists take as they find, often without a huge knowledge of the technology, but just kicking it around the studio and seeing what they could get out of it. As far as the audience is concerned, that has also changed a lot. I remember an exhibition at the Serpentine Gallery in the 90s, where there was a little room where there was a computer, this is in about 92 or 3, where you could go to a thing called a website and look at extra material about the exhibition. The queue through the galleries waiting to go and look at this, there were more people in that queue than there were actually looking at the things that were actually in the exhibition in front of you. There was this aura around the kind of virtual, which I think has now gone. And one of the things about the Whitechapel show is it does show the vast range and diversity of the kinds of ways in which people are using, either using tech or commenting on it. I mean, it's a fascinating mess of an exhibition. And you're going from sculptures to photographs to things on browsers to video installations. There's one work by an artist who, a huge scroll of paper that comes down, avalanches off the wall and on, across the floor. And it's got images from everything he looked at in his sort of surfing for one day. And it's sort of frightening when you see it. You know, if you look at your browser history, it's one thing, but to see all those images kind of cascading around you is quite another.
I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the art that we're talking about, you know, when you look at tangibly what it is that we create using the internet every single day, and you put it in a concrete physical format, like, for instance, that roll of paper, suddenly it changes very much the substance of what it is that we're engaged with. And I wonder if you think that there's a sense that the optimism and playfulness with which artists and people who are not artists but who viewed up to see the first websites, the optimism with which many of us greeted the initial shift in technology of having access to computers, whether this optimism has now started to become replaced by an increasing unease or anxiety around its use.
Unease and anxiety goes with the territory of the world that we live in today. You know, these fractures and shears between our what we like to laughingly call our real selves and our avatars, our virtual and real presence in the world, it has become blurred and it's full of holes. And certainly for someone of my generation, born in the 1950s, that anxiety is a kind of permanent state.
Now, Helen, I'm sure you've got something to add here. I can see you sort of wanting to come in.
I was just going to say that in terms of this kind of flood of information that we're talking about in relation to anxiety and this mass of material that we're presented with in, say, the Evan Roth work of The Scroll, is actually a lot of the ideas around chance, experimentation, those early ideas of we can go anywhere, and now this idea that maybe we can go anywhere and we can access anything. But actually, the internet that we all access is relatively small. In terms of anxiety, I think we're all maybe performing this anxiety to quite a closed community and perhaps just to ourselves.
I take your point, and I think it's a good one. But an imagined anxiety makes you anxious.
Yeah,
just as much as a real one.
Absolutely.
Are there any key themes then when we're looking at things like communities being able to connect together, or the sense of privacy or surveillance? We've already identified a few of the themes. Are there any other key themes that we perceive that keep emerging within arts commentary on technology?
Well, just in terms of the Whitechapel show, maybe relating it to this idea of community and anxiety, I think one of the really strong themes or the works by artists who I thought were really interesting that drew an interesting thread was kind of queering technology. And Ryan Trey Carton and Jeremy Bailey and Zach Blass are all really interesting artists on the ground floor who are talking about that. And they're also talking about self-surveillance and the performativity and the kind of queerness that's produced in the image of the self that's kind of constantly reproduced for the self.
So we've been talking quite a bit about exhibitions, but moving beyond the four walls of the gallery has been something that the artist Ruth Catlow has been doing as an artist in her own right since she started Furtherfield. Ruth, can you give us an idea about what Furtherfield is and how it works?
Yeah, Furtherfield is community. It's an artist-led community and organisation for arts, technology and social change. We got going in the mid-90s, really, as Brit Art was occupying London and as the web was getting going as a space that anyone could publish to. We kind of started and were inspired by Backspace, which was one of the kind of first London-based creative cyber cafes on Clink Street, backing onto the Thames. You could climb out the window onto the Thames, and the website had a map of the tide coming in and out. So always this kind of connection between space and online things. We were able to make our own context on the web. We were able to make our own web pages and then able to kind of teach ourselves how to kind of create social spaces that allowed us to create our own social context as artists. And these were contexts that allowed us to create things differently, distribute, critique, remix, reappropriate. And it really kind of shifted this idea of the kind of individual genius artist and helped us to understand kind of artistic processes as connected to social and political processes. And so Furtherfield has now developed as a space. We have a gallery in the heart of Finsbury Park in North London. We also have a lab space where people can get their hands on stuff and work out how to make technology work for them and their friends. And we have a large online space for critique and review and debate.
So we've got the internet as a creative space and a medium, possibly a gallery. Why do you think that many artists now choose to exhibit their work still in galleries, when surely a website app or some kind of online environment would be a better vehicle?
Why it's important to have physical spaces to show this work is because as human beings we like to be in spaces together, and we need this wide bandwidth. We need the wide bandwidth of real life, and we understand artworks better when we stand in spaces together with a drink in our hand or a cup of tea or what have you, and are able to talk in a more broad way than is allowable through these kind of very confined spaces.
So can you tell us, I'm really intrigued, a little bit about your artwork?
Yes. So I'm, as a practitioner, I'm an artist. I'm also an organiser, a techie, some kind of techie, a curator. I participate as often as I initiate, I would say. And that's probably quite typical of people working in our network. I've just made a work at the moment that was commissioned by Michael Shpakovsky for part of a show called We Are Not Alone, which is up in Scunthorpe at the moment, which is a show which touches on similar themes about kind of what it means to be an artist in the internet age. And this work is it's a work called Time is Speeding Up, and it's about how as I get older, I feel like time is speeding up. And as I talk to people who are a little bit older than me, they all nod frantically at me when I talk about this. And on the web, it's even more accelerated. Yeah. And there's a whole kind of area of discourse at the moment about accelerationism and about how technology and high capitalism are having us kind of hurtling in a kind of line towards a kind of environmental and economic and social kind of crisis. And so I've made a time machine. They're just going to have to go and look it up. I've made a time machine. That's my claim. It's a live network video piece that is real time. People can go and insert themselves into it and they will experience time speeding up as a result. They'll just have to go and check it out.
People have always had this fear, haven't they? I mean, people thought that railway trains people would suffocate in railway trains because they were going too fast to be able to catch the air and breathe. And then William Burroughs in his 1970s book Electronic Revolution kind of voiced a lot of the things that you've just been speaking about in this book when there was no internet, really.
I think it's not necessarily specific to the internet, but it's probably part of the wider industrialization process that we have this kind of linear time, which is now we're kind of locked into it and we are moving faster.
So the work that you've just described includes people experiencing and inserting them into the arts. So it seems that quite a lot of your work requires users to co-create in some form or other. Well, let's look at the authorship, because I think the authorship and ownership and who owns the art, if everyone's collaborating and you've kind of facilitated it, but you're also participating in it.
Okay, so this is kind of like central interest to both interest and preoccupation, I would say, to myself and many of the people who I work with, which is this sense of how the internet has allowed us to understand the difference between our agency as individuals and our agency collectively and societally wide and community wide, and understanding our relationship with all these kind of different scales of how the world is shaped and how the world is changed. And I'd say that the reason I was struggling to answer your question about how the work is made is because there are many different ways, depending on what it is that we are trying to do. So sometimes one might set a frame in which one sets a really simple instruction. So there's an artist called Annie Abrahams, whose work I really like very much. She's a network performance artist. And she will create very kind of quite austere interfaces. And she'll invite people to come and perform a very simple action together in a space. They see themselves performing together. You see very complex interactions between people. And really, it's about how people accept and respond to an instruction. And in that way, you get to see how we as human beings respond to being told to do things or invited to do things. So that's one thing. And sometimes participation or collaboration is managed through stealth. So sometimes you'll ask somebody to do something, and actually it's what they don't do is what makes the collaboration or what makes the work. So there's all these kind of, there's a kind of continuum of participation that artists have really kind of played with and explored, and now, for better or for worse, the kind of huge corporations have learned an awful lot, and they're kind of using these things, you know, that we are now involved globally on a mass experiment on kind of human behaviour with these computers that are now in our pocket and tracking and mapping, witting or unwitting participation in these data gathering systems.
So speaking about data, we are going to shortly be looking at two people who are dealing with this data explosion in very different ways. They've both been featured at the Big Bang Data Exhibition in Somerset House, and that's after this.
If you're a developer working on a mobile app or website and you're searching for a simple payment solution, look no further than Braintree V.0. This snippet of code allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more from customers around the world, all with a single integration. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly now.
So we now know that every single day our online activity chalks up a really incredible amount of data, and that more than ever this data is up for grabs. But how is it that the art world is engaging with this, and perhaps some of the anxieties that we mentioned earlier about the use of our data? An exhibition at Somerset House looks at the explosion of data in recent years and tries to answer some of these questions. So that's from a piece called We Need Us by one of our guests, artist Julie Freeman. Julie, what is it that we're actually listening to in that piece?
So the work is a piece of work that uses data as an art material, and it explores a source of metadata that comes from a citizen science website called the Zooniverse. So all the different compositions, come from different projects. So there's projects like Bat Detective, which is the sound you just heard. And that looks at when people are online, they're analysing sounds from the environment that have been recorded. And when they think they hear a bat, then they submit a flag to a database and they say, yeah, I think that's a bat. I think that's this type of bat. And then the information surrounding that process is what I've then converted into sound and animation. So it's data about data that is generated by someone else looking at another set of data.
Wow. So, I mean, it's very, very mesmerizing when you hear this. It just feels like you're transported into a very experiential kind of world. Like, I actually had an emotional reaction when I listened to that, which I was not expecting.
Yeah. I think it's the treatment of data in the work is, I think, fairly delicate, and it's subtle, and it looks at the way that there's this huge masses of information. And we talked in the first half, I guess, of the programme about data and this the fear of data through surveillance and that. But We Need Us is almost a bit of a celebration of the material that's being generated all the time by our online activities. And I think that, you know, it's this idea of how en masse we've become a sort of social machine that has been facilitated by the machines around us. So digital technology, the internet, and then the web that we use on the internet has allowed us to become these kind of machines.
How is the art world engaging with some of the anxieties that we mentioned earlier about the use of our data?
Well, I think I'm lucky enough to work with the Open Data Institute, and they have an art programme that I lead with curator Hannah Redler. And we work with artists of all kinds and all types on commissioning new work, and we exhibit works. We've worked with people recently, a photographic artist called Natasha Caruana, and her work is mainly photographic. She's quite performative as well, but sometimes it's not obvious where the data is within that work. But she actually uses the internet to, get a lot of her source material. She did a whole project about married men, which she went out on loads of dates with married men and took covert photographs. And then people were saying, well, where's the data in the work? And then the Ashley Madison thing broke. And suddenly it's like, well, actually, you know, there's the data is really pertinent to that project. And what she's doing is highlighting that it's not just in the tech world, in the data world, in worlds that we're familiar, that it's everywhere and that we should be paying attention. And earlier on, someone was saying about this idea that we have a lack of control over data. And we have a lack of control over some of it, but there is some that we do have control, and we choose not to take control of it, because we want entertainment, we want communication, we want, you know, connection with people. And you can choose to opt out of that stuff, but we actually don't. So it's about being better educated, having better data literacy.
So would you say that different types of data have different characters?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, different sets of data, different data from different sources do have different characters, different personalities. So it's like any material that you're working with. The more you know about it, the more you can extract those features and you can make differences from it. So in We Need Us, for instance, there's 10 different compositions. The data for each of those compositions comes from a different project on Zooniverse, and each of them have a slightly different feeling, a different visual aesthetic, a different sonic aesthetic. So it's a really clear indication that they do have different personalities.
So we also have with us in the studio, talking about how to translate this data into meaningful forms, journalist David McCandless, who runs Information is Beautiful. What do you feel about the way in which we can use data to create something which is beautiful and maybe that we can interact with in a different kind of way?
Well, I share Julie's view that data feels like a kind of material, a new kind of material, a virtual material, and it feels like a substance when you're working with it. You have to clean it, you have to dig through it, you get your hands dirty with data. And when you work creatively in that way with it as a material, pieces of art, visualizations, infographics, they're like flowers that can bloom from this soil, data substance.
So talking about different aesthetics, David, your focus is on infographics. When it comes to data visualization, there's always a risk that the extremes in data tend to look more dramatic and therefore actually quite more exciting than the nuances. Do you think that there's a potential pitfall around making statistics look sexy so that you end up making seductive but unrepresentative propaganda, if I can take it to the absolute extreme point?
No, I think that's fair. I think you can lie with statistics, and you can really lie with visualized statistics, because it carries the power of numbers and the power of visuals, which are both hard to argue and both used to overpower people in society. So yeah, I think in the hands of non-ethical organizations and power brokers and so on, data has that scary dystopian atmosphere to it. But in the hands of creators and people that are interested in co-creation and participation and exploration, then I think it just feels like a very exciting new material that we can all just play with and see where it leads us.
Do you think there's something in the role of the artist as the steward of the open internet, of continuing to bring people into collaboration so that it's not entirely commercialized and commoditized by these big companies?
I think artists will always find a way. No matter how tightly contained or observed or surveyed the internet is, there will always be ways to get around it, always ways to escape from that and to replenish and create and flourish as creative people. So I don't find it that intimidating. I just think it's a bit more of a challenge now.
Helen, you'd like to jump in?
Oh, I was just going to say that, yeah, this is something that's really interesting that I think we're going to cover in the course at Tate Britain as well, is this question of the role of the artist as a creative visionary now collapsing into perhaps the role of the technologist or the hacker, whereas we used to see the artist as the individual who would be at the bleeding edge of visioning our future. You see hackers now in Berlin and in Athens living communally in a way that very much mirrors the ways that artists were living in the 1930s and the 1970s, and there's this kind of optimism around collective visioning, which Ruth was talking about as well.
So what do you think are the most exciting comments on the datification of our world that are being made? Julie, I'm going to start with you.
I guess the thing that I find most exciting about working with data is the idea that it can be real-time live. You know, this idea that data can describe time and space and you can play with time and space. I mean, Ruth talking about making a time machine is exactly that. You know, it allows you to do this weird stuff that you can't do with analog materials. And so, yeah, that's excites me.
All right. Adrian, how about you?
Well, I'm a very analog being. I leak everywhere. This interface between the data and the digital and the physical, and I think we do need the physical. We need galleries and we need objects. We need stuff because that's what we are. It's made the plastic arts more plastic and more pliable rather than cutting them out and saying this is all old stuff, old. You know, we're all in the digital now. It's the way everything is coming together, I think, is incredibly exciting.
All right. Helen, how about you?
Well, something that we haven't really talked about today, but is a major interest of mine, is the commons and many of the very optimistic moments in relation to the history of art and technology as technology enabling the circulation of information and this being a kind of liberating and democratic force. And although corporations have closed the gates on many of these opportunities, I think there are still opportunities for a data commons, and many of the best artists out there making work about art and technology, because of their politics in relation to property, have made their work available online. So Ryan Tracarton, the video artist who we were talking about previously, most of his video works are all online and available. Many of the artists in the show, such as Erica Scorti, who's a Greek artist based in London, who's in the Somerset House show, has a brilliant blog, and further field have a brilliant mailing list. And there are many, many ways to kind of access and share conversations, which I find really exciting.
David?
Yeah, I feel technology has given us new avenues and dimensions for play, and playing with data initiates some kind of alchemical process where the lead of data can be turned into the gold of art or visualization or graphics and meaning and understanding, and people love that stuff, so great.
And Ruth?
We showed an artist called Jennifer Lynn Marone at a recent show about art, data and money, and I think she does something that we consider to be really important, which is make the kind of politics and power of these essentially what feel like abstract medium to people feelable and kind of odd. So Jennifer Lynn Marone incorporated herself and is looking at how she can commodify all aspects of her identity, body, all the different aspects of herself. And as we imagine how we might become shareholders in Jennifer Lynn Marone, we get to feel in our own bodies through empathy what it means for her that she's doing this. And I think that this is why art is really important. It helps to make these abstract kind of power tools feelable to us all.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. So with that, it's all we have time for this week. Thank you to all my guests, to curator Helen Kaplinsky, chief art critic for The Guardian, Adrian Searle, artists Ruth Catlow and Julie Freeman, and data journalist David McCandless. Our producer this week has been the lovely Alana Chance, and we will be back next week with more on tech. See you then.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.